What are the manifestations of COVID-19 infection in pregnancy?
Addressing weight loss in underserved patients.
Is there a disparity between self-perceived and objectively measured hearing loss?
And can flu vaccination inform us about COVID vaccination?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think the top of mind one for me, at least this week, is this analysis of whether flu vaccination can model for us what we might do when it comes to coronavirus vaccinations. This is in the Journal of General Internal Medicine.
To put it in perspective, everybody's talking about the COVID vaccine being an important part of preventing disease in the future, but there are many individuals that are unlikely to get vaccinated, and so we won't be able to develop that herd immunity. What these authors attempted to do is to inform us about what type of individuals do or don't get flu vaccines, because the things that influence that are very likely to influence who gets COVID vaccination. And in fact, when you look at the demographics regarding flu, and I'm just going to talk about the 2017-2018 season, there were 45 million symptomatic cases in the U.S. and over 61,000 deaths. But under half of U.S. adults and only two-thirds of children are vaccinated, despite the fact the goal is to have 80%. So the authors looked at an annual national survey of over 400,000 adults conducted by the CDC and state health departments, looked at vaccination rates, the state, geography, age, race, sex, annual income, chronic conditions, to determine who was or who wasn't likely to get vaccinated. They were able to detain over 95% of the data on over 400,000 adults, and unfortunately estimated only one-third of them actually were vaccinated. Vaccination rates were higher among older, white, and Asian, female, higher income adults, and those with chronic conditions. The ages over 75 had three times higher adjusted rates of getting vaccinated as people in 18 to 24. And unfortunately, Black and Native Americans had a 17% lower odds of vaccination than white adults. And you won't be surprised to know that having health insurance and a personal physician were independently associated with a twofold higher rate of vaccination. Disappointingly to me, the state of Texas, the vaccination rate was only 26% versus the highest rate in the District of Columbia, 44%. This information hopefully will allow us to target these individuals that are unlikely to get vaccinated, not only for flu vaccines, but also when the COVID vaccine becomes available.
I think one of the things that comes instantly to mind when I listen to this is the fact that as we get older, we interact more with the healthcare system. And it just seems likely to me that in that interaction, there's going to be the suggestion or the recommendation that we get vaccinated for the flu.
You're right. I mean, they're more likely to see a primary care physician, and that's related. They're more likely to have insurance because of Medicare as well. And they're more likely to have chronic conditions, so they interact with the healthcare system. Again, our target's 80%. There wasn't a single group that had a 60% or higher vaccination rate. So we got a lot of work to do just across the spectrum.
And of course, the big concerns right now about oncoming COVID-19 vaccine are that we're worried about, is it going to be approved before it's really ready, before the data is really ripe?
We certainly need to encourage people to get vaccinated for flu. There's no question about that. As the COVID vaccine becomes available and is proven to be efficacious, and we now have three that are in phase 3 studies here in the United States and others worldwide, then we'll be able to adopt them. But if we don't do a better job disseminating the flu vaccine, we're not going to do any better with the COVID vaccine when it's finally available.
And I would just add one more thing, having listened to quite a lot about this vaccine coming over the transom, with so many activities being curtailed or frankly closed, points of contact for people to be administered the vaccine, which most people feel is going to be a 2-dose kind of a vaccine, are fewer. And so there's all kinds of concerns about that part of it as well.
You're right. There's a lot of obstacles to overcome. The information I just highlighted was when there was no restrictions. A lot of structural things we need to overcome.
On an upside, I would say that at least recently, pharmacists are now empowered to give vaccinations even to the pediatric population. And so pharmacists, I think, are going to be a point of contact for many of us when it comes to this. Let's turn to the British Medical Journal. This is a look at that population in whom there was a lot of controversy. Gosh, what is the impact of COVID-19 infection in women who are pregnant? This is a meta-analysis. They included in this 28 studies over 11,000 women, pregnant, recently pregnant, attending or admitted to hospital for any reason, and were diagnosed as having suspected or confirmed COVID-19. Interestingly, their clinical manifestations did not include fever and cough, as they do for so many other people. They were less likely to report either fever or muscle aches and pains. However, they were more likely to need admission to an intensive care unit and invasive ventilation. In this study, they only see 0.1% deaths among pregnant women, and I think there's still some fuzziness surrounding that number, so I'm not convinced. I want to see a little bit more. But in any case, what were the risk factors? The same risk factors that we see for anybody getting severe COVID-19 disease. High BMI, chronic hypertension, pre-existing diabetes. When women had this, they were more likely to get severe COVID-19 during pregnancy. So the pregnancy seems like it was almost an aside. Okay, so what about what happens with the baby? A quarter of all these neonates were admitted to the NICU. They were not, though, more likely to die than kids whose moms did not have COVID-19.
A really interesting study, and they're calling it a living systematic review and meta-analysis, because here's what happened. Early on, there were case reports or small series, and then people began to accumulate these, and some reported them in a meta-analysis, and there'd be another couple cases or a small study, and it would be updated, and the ball just kept rolling. It got very difficult to stay up with all the information. So they collected all the information to date and then continued to update their analysis. So this is the most current, up-to-date, and the largest series reported on the outcomes in pregnant women and with the outcomes of their births as well. As you mentioned, the mothers that had those chronic illnesses were 4 times more likely to be in an intensive care unit or on a ventilator. Fortunately, the death rate is fairly low, but again, that's because their mothers are relatively young age, even despite the comorbidities.
Well, I think that one of the concerns about pregnancy was the anergic condition, and if there's already sort of an immune compromise, is COVID-19 disease going to be worse? And I think that in this case, I'm kind of buoyed by the data that it's not showing that it would be worse if you weren't obese, had hypertension, and diabetes.
Yep. Well, so it's interesting. The way the study was constructed, they looked at pregnant women with or without comorbidities and COVID infection. They didn't compare it to a similarly aged group that weren't pregnant. So it's hard to make that comparison directly. It is somewhat reassuring that the death rate is fairly low. The interesting thing about this study that we didn't talk about was that many centers now routinely test pregnant women to see whether they're COVID infected or not, because the vast majority of women are asymptomatic. And in fact, what they found out is in some of these studies, as many as 10% of the women tested positive for COVID and really didn't demonstrate the normal symptoms.
Yeah, more coming, I'm sure. Let's turn to your next one. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine.
This was a really well-done study looking at weight loss in underserved patients. Multiple studies have looked at intensive coaching in terms of encouraging and sustaining weight loss, but very few of those studies have been done in underserved populations and centered in primary care clinics. So the question is, are those particular techniques helpful in this population? So these authors conducted what's called a cluster randomized trial to test the effectiveness of a high-intensity lifestyle-based program for treating obesity, and it was centered in primary care clinics. 18 clinics, 9 received the intensive lifestyle changes and 9 just the usual care. And the study went on for 24 months. With the intensive lifestyle, what they did was they embedded health coaches in the clinics, and they had weekly sessions for the first 6 months, followed by monthly sessions for the remaining 18 months, and they followed the individuals for 24. I'm happy to report that in this 800-patient study, the individuals that were in the intensive lifestyle change had a 5% reduction in weight versus the usual care, where essentially there was no change. It was 0.5%. The major weight loss was done at 1 year. The average weight was 7%, so they gained a little bit between 1 and 2 years, but it was still sustained at 2 years. 67% of the individuals in the study were Black and had an annual income less than $40,000. 83% completed the study, so it's doable. And most of these individuals were women, so a really great study.
I like this, of course, because what we have been seeing in abundance with the COVID-19 pandemic has been this disproportionate impact on people who are overweight and of other ethnicities. And so if we can establish this intervention low cost, right where they live, and actually have a positive impact, I think that's a win-win.
Right. It didn't involve any pharmacy or medications, no side effects. Again, I think it's a terrific study. I'm glad you picked it. This makes a significant difference. And by the way, it improved their quality of life as well. I know that you're not surprised by that.
Finally, let's turn to JAMA Network Open. And I like this one because it's something that I think we're seeing in abundance, that a man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest in so many venues relative to health. In this case, this is a look at an aging population and their self-assessment of their hearing loss compared to an objective assessment of the hearing loss. This is part of the English Longitudinal Study of Aging. This is a population-based prospective cohort study that's been looking at aging folks in England for a while now. This cohort had 9,600 plus individuals. It's called their Wave 7. And they asked these people, hey, do you have any hearing loss? And then they compared that to a screening test that was done by a qualified nurse to see whether or not they really did have it. They also corrected for other things: age, marital status, retirement status, indicators of socioeconomic position, lifestyle factors, including BMI, physical activity, and tobacco and alcohol consumption. And then they said, hey, how does this impact on our self-reported hearing problems or our objective measures? Basically, a third of them said, I really don't have a problem, and they did have a problem. Interestingly, I thought this was fascinating because normally I think it's men who tell themselves stories about things, but it turns out that female SAGs was more highly associated with this dissociation, this discordance between objective and self measures of hearing loss.
So Elizabeth, this is kind of the rule of thirds. If you just take a look across older Americans, a third of them have significant hearing loss. And as you mentioned, a third of those individuals didn't even know it. I mean, they thought, oh, my hearing's fine. But then when you test it, it's not. And we've talked before about that's not only a quality of life issue, but a long-term cognitive impairment is associated with hearing loss as well. So what you want to do is you want to recognize it, and it's easily treatable with hearing aids, but it's only treatable if people know that it's going on. This suggests we need to be doing routine hearing tests in older individuals. As you noted, women were twice as likely as men to not know they had a hearing loss. True story. This week, I'm on the phone. My wife says, can you talk? And I said, I'm on hold. She thought I said, I am old. Perhaps I need to have my wife's hearing tested. But there are other things that were associated with the lack of recognition. As people that had manual jobs, people that had no educational qualifications, and people that had poor lifestyle choices that either smoked tobacco, had a high alcohol intake, or didn't perform much physical activity. All of those things were associated with the lack of recognition that people had a hearing loss.
Well, as you said, certainly we have hearing aids that are available to help rectify this particular problem. I do not think we have data yet that establish whether or not the use of hearing aids ameliorates many of the other problems that are associated with hearing loss.
I would grant the fact that, again, hearing loss has been associated with cognitive impairment and an increased cognitive decline. I think it's pretty clear that hearing aids can improve quality of life, even if for that, or to communicate better with your marital partner or spouse, I think important as well.
On that note then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.